Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with incriminating emails between the State Department and a Canadian oil company which plans to build an oil pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta across the US to Texas. Kim Nguyen, the director of the Dirty Fuels Program at Friends of the Earth, who obtained these emails through a Freedom of Information request, joins us to discuss a cozy relationship where the State Department, instead of exercising oversight, is facilitating the oil pipeline. Then on the first day of a two-day meeting between Afghan President Karzai and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh of India, we will examine the strategic agreement just announced between India and Pakistan, India and Afghanistan, that is bound to antagonize Pakistan. Ashley Tellis, who served on the National Security Council staff as a special assistant to the President and Senior Director of Strategic Planning and Southwest Asia, joins us to discuss the content of the agreement and its implications as India tries to fill a strategic vacuum with the impending withdrawal of NATO and the US from Afghanistan in 2014. Then finally, we'll try to assess the deteriorating health of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and the likely power struggle that will follow his incapacitation if it comes to that. Javier Corrales, the co-author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, joins us to discuss possible secession and the internal politics of this volatile and polarized country. And joining us now is Kim Nguyen, the director of the Dirty Fuels Program at Friends of the Earth, an environmental organization that recently obtained emails between the State Department and the lead lobbyist for the Keystone XL pipeline that provide evidence of a pro-industry bias and indicate a cozy relationship between the State Department and the Canadian oil company. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Nguyen.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I take it that you are involved with this effort to get these emails from the State Department through the Freedom of Information Act. This is the second batch of 200, is that right?
That's correct.
And are there more coming?
Yes, we do expect more documents to be forthcoming from the State Department. And we've so far gotten documents from four State Department offices.
But not from the Secretary of State?
Not yet.
I see. So, but the smoking gun, if you will, in these emails is that many of them involve the head lobbyists who served as Hillary Clinton's deputy campaign manager in her campaign for president in 2008, Paul Elliott. And It's these emails between Paul Elliott and diplomatic staff in the U.S. Embassy in Canada, in Ottawa, particularly the person involved with environment and energy issues, Marja Verloop, that particularly raise questions.
That's correct.
So just elaborate on that, if you will.
Sure. Well, we feel like these new documents that we've received from the second batch really corroborate that the State Department is not only simply biased in their role assessing the environmental impacts of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline and whether the pipeline is in the national interest, but also has been complicit. They show a senior energy counselor, as you mentioned, Marja Verloop, who works at the State Department, cheering on unequivocally for Paul Elliott, who is TransCanada's lead D.C. lobbyist, as well as you mentioned, the former deputy national campaign director on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And we see her cheering on Paul Elliott for his success, quote-unquote, in gaining an elected official support for the pipeline. This is extremely inappropriate for an employee of an agency that is supposed to be impartially, independently reviewing the pipeline. And we think that, again, it demonstrates that the State Department is not only biased simply in their assessment, but also that they've been complicit.
And the particular politician that Ms. Verloops congratulated Elliott on the good news that he had persuaded Senator Max Baucus of Montana to back the pipeline, she wrote, "Go, Paul." Now, of course, Montana, I imagine the pipeline is going through Montana, right?
That is correct, yes.
So tell me it's obviously that the Canadian company, TransCanada, chose the right lobbyist, did they not? I mean, this is the former deputy campaign manager for Hillary Clinton in her losing bid for president. Presumably he's got access. I suppose to that extent, you have to congratulate them?
TransCanada knew exactly what they were doing by hiring Paul Elliott. And again, as I mentioned, Paul Elliott was a former high-ranking aide on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And in the emails, it confirms that in one exchange between Maria Verloop and Paul Elliott, Maria Verloop confirmed that he was precisely, as she put it, hired because he has connections, and that he was sought after because he has connections with folks at the State Department. We have, from our first batch of documents received through our Freedom of Information Act, those documents also support the notion that that Paul Elliott was using his campaign ties during the Hillary Clinton campaign, the presidential campaign, to gain high level meetings with employees at the State Department.
Well, apparently, the State Department, their role is key in this, obviously, because they're the ones that will recommend to the president whether or not this pipeline goes ahead and is built between the tar sands of Alberta and refineries in Texas, crossing a number of American states. So they're obviously, the State Department's decision is critical. However, what has already happened here, from what I understand, Kim Nguyen, is that that the State Department picked a consulting firm to write the environmental impact statement on the Keystone Pipeline, and they chose a company called Cardno Entrix, whose chief clients was TransCanada.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
Absolutely. I mean, we really think this is very precisely an incident of the fox guarding the hen house. And it's important to remember that we're receiving these documents from the State Department, and that these documents are not appearing in a vacuum. Rather, they're occurring within an entire context in which there are already very, very serious concerns about the State Department's bias, and that these new emails are really particularly damning, given that Secretary Clinton made a comment last fall 2010, that she was inclined, quote-unquote, to approve the pipeline as well as to approve the pipeline. And this was before her agency was even able to complete a comprehensive environmental review of the project or go through the process of national interest determination. We also know that these documents, these emails, exist in concert with a WikiLeaks document indicating that State Department officials, quote-unquote, alleviated Canadian officials' concerns and provided them with messaging advice. And as you mentioned, there's been a lot of controversy around this third-party consulting firm, Cardno Entrix, that had been brought in by the State Department to complete the environmental impact statement and also to run the hearings that have been happening all through the last couple weeks. All of these things really add up to a monumental case of extreme bias and complicity at the State Department, and we think it's entirely unacceptable.
And, of course, surprise, surprise, the environmental impact report by the company that is closely associated with the TransCanada, who are the who are lobbying the State Department for permission to build this pipeline. The environmental report said that there'll be no significant impact on the nearby land and water resources of the various U.S. States that this pipeline would traverse. Again, I'm speaking with Kim Nguyen, the director of the Dirty Fuels Program at Friends of the Earth, an environmental organization that recently obtained emails between the State Department and the lead lobbyist for the Keystone XL pipeline, emails that provide evidence of a pro-industry bias and indicate a cozy relationship between the State Department and the Canadian company. So I think as bad as these things are, Kim, that you've uncovered through the Freedom of Information request that you put forth to the State Department, and as you mentioned, there's some more coming. Perhaps they may involve the higher up, including the Secretary Hillary Clinton. But what we know now is pretty damning. The State Department officials in July advised the Keystone XL pipeline that the pressure that they wanted to put the crude to ship the crude under was too high and wouldn't be allowed in the United States and wouldn't win political support. But they suggested that they should lower the pressure requests, and then later they can reapply once the project's underway to up the pressure. I mean, talk about leading the witness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and this further provides evidence of the type of coaching and insider information and support that was given to TransCanada officials from the State Department. The exchange that you just mentioned, actually, between Maria Verloop and some of her other cohorts at the State Department, demonstrates that throughout this process, the State Department has really been making it a priority to make sure that TransCanada is "quote unquote" comfortable and on board with the entire process. And again, this bias is extremely unacceptable for an agency that's supposed to be acting in the public interest and assessing this pipeline on its science-based environmental merits. We think that this is absolutely atrocious, what's been happening, what's been uncovered, and President Obama really has a responsibility to rescind the permitting authority from the State Department, given that it can no longer be trusted as a credible arbiter on Keystone XL.
Well, what is clear about these emails that you've uncovered, Kim Nguyen, is that the people who are dealing with this very important issue, I mean, it's so important, for example, that the chief scientist at NASA, Jim Hansen, says that if this project goes ahead, and all of this incredibly heavy carbon, dirty fuel is transported to refineries in Texas, that it will be game over for the environment. And as you know, thousands of environmentalists have camped out in front of the White House and they've been arrested, including Bill McKibben, who has an op-ed piece in Tuesday's New York Times condemning this cozy relationship that you've uncovered here between the State Department and the Canadian company. But what is clear about these email exchanges is that none of these people have any expertise. All they have is connections. And the State Department's job is to do an environmental impact, not to massage the Canadian client of the Hillary's former deputy campaign manager.
That's right, Ian. I think we would agree with you there. Their job as an agency here was to look at the science and look at the potentially catastrophic impacts of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. And they've failed. They've been called out by other federal agencies for having failed to assess the impacts of Keystone XL. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, actually gave a draft environmental impact statement of the State Department a failing grade, Category 3 failing grade. And it's obvious that the State Department really cannot be seen as a credible arbiter on the Keystone XL pipeline question anymore. President Obama can and should immediately rescind the permitting authority for the pipeline.
Well, what would that mean, though? He has to make the ultimate decision. So what's going to happen here is that the State Department will approve this pipeline or rescind it. But if they approve it, then the decision then goes on to the president, right? It's their recommendation that goes to the president. He's the ultimate decider, right? As George Bush used to say, I'm the decider.
So what's essentially what's essentially happened is that President Obama, through a presidential, through an executive order, has given the power to approve or reject the pipeline to the State Department. So he's given them, because it is a transboundary pipeline that crosses from Canada through the United States, it has ultimately been given to the State Department to decide. But President Obama can take that back. He can rescind the permitting authority for the pipeline from the State Department, and he really should. Here we have a president who ran on the campaign promise to end the days of lobbyists setting the agenda in Washington. That's a direct quote. And meanwhile, his own State Department has been shamelessly facilitating handing over the Keystone XL pipeline to big oil firm TransCanada when they were really supposed to be conducting an independent, science-based analysis.
And what about the states over which this pipeline is going to cross, from Alberta down to Texas, Alberta, Canada down to Texas? So tell me about the states that are involved, and has Paul Elliott, Hillary's former deputy campaign manager, now chief lobbyist for the Canadian company that want to build the Keystone XL pipeline, presumably there's been some lobbying going on with state governorships and legislatures. That would be, I think, fairly predictable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, our documents, we don't have documents that show that. I think it's a safe assumption that that was indeed happening.
Well, that's why he got Senator Max Baucus, right, the senator for Montana, on board.
Mm-hmm. Well, it shows that he did email to a list of State Department employees that Senator Baucus had come on board in supporting the pipeline. And as far as evidence that shows that he was active in lobbying Senate and legislative offices, you know, I can't speak to that because our documents were specifically targeted at correspondence between the State Department and Paul Elliott. But I think it's safe to assume that he was. The State Department is about to complete its hearings in all the states that the pipeline would go through, plus one in Port Arthur, Texas, and one in D.C. this week. And I think one thing that has come out from these state hearings is that this pipeline, there's unprecedented public opposition to this pipeline, and millions of Americans are opposed to this pipeline. Thousands showed up throughout all the states that the pipeline would go through in opposition to the pipeline. And this is actually in the face of quite a bit of bullying and aggressive tactics on the part of TransCanada and other on the part of TransCanada to bring in different tactics to ward off opposition. But all of this of course is important context, but the really important thing to remember here is that, again, ultimately this is President Obama's decision, and this is ultimately a question of the amount of power that corporations have in Washington. And what President Obama can do to keep his campaign promises to end the days of lobbyists setting the agenda in Washington. And what he really needs to do is rescind permitting authority for the pipeline from the State Department, because it's been shown that throughout this entire process, given all the evidence from all the documents we've received, given Secretary Clinton's comment last fall that she was inclined to approve the pipeline, and other information that was released through a WikiLeak that the State Department was providing messaging, advice, and coaching, all of these prove that the State Department is no longer trustworthy as an independent arbiter, as an independent judge of whether Keystone XL pipeline should be
approved
or not.
Well, clearly they haven't been an oversight agency. They've been a facilitator, and clearly choosing the company to do the environmental impact study already connected to TransCanada, and that this company needs to say found that there'd be no significant impact on the nearby land and water across these United States, these states that are affected. That should get people out in those states. Because we simply can't take their word that this pipeline, whose pressure has been deliberately down, the pressure inside that pipeline has been deliberately downplayed, and they once they get the permitting, then they're going to up the pressure, meaning there's more likelihood of a leakage. So, thank you for joining us. I appreciate the work that you've done, Kim Nguyen.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Kim Nguyen, the director of the Dirty Fuels Program at Friends of the Earth, an environmental organization that recently obtained emails between the State Department and the head lobbyist for the Keystone XL pipeline. Emails that provide evidence of a pro-industry bias and indicate a cozy relationship between the State Department and the Canadian oil company. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the strategic deal that has been signed between India and Afghanistan that is likely to antagonize Pakistan.
When it gets down to the cities, then the water turns into a dirty gray. It's poisoned and polluted by the people as it flows along its way. Don't go near the water, children, see the fish all dead upon the shore. Don't go near the water, water isn't water anymore.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now?
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ashley Tellis, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. Previously, he was commissioned into the Foreign Service and served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi and as senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He also served on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the President and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ashley Tellis.
Thank you, Ian.
And the agreement that was announced today in New Delhi between in a meeting at the beginning of a two-day meeting between the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. What do we know of it so far? I mean, what's been sketched out in the press releases is pretty thin. It is actually worth noting. It's the first agreement that Afghanistan has gone into.
That is correct. The evidence that we have for the details right now, as you said, is very spotty. Two themes seem to appear in all the press reports. One, the Indian commitment to stand by Afghanistan for the long term, meaning beyond the security transition in 2014. And the second, the Indian willingness to continue supporting Afghan national security forces through training and possibly through other forms of assistance that might be mutually negotiated. These are the two elements that seem to have made all the headlines in the reporting so far.
But in terms of filling the strategic vacuum when the United States and NATO withdraw by 2014, or start their withdrawal by 2014, that's finessed, because that would inflame Pakistan, wouldn't it? Any notion of replacing American and NATO troops with Indian troops?
I think that is right, but I don't think that is the Indian intent. I don't think the Indians are communicating a willingness to actually send troops into Afghanistan. What they appear to be saying is that they are prepared to backfill any deficits that may arise in terms of the raising and support of Afghan national security forces, which means, bringing the officer corps to India and training them, probably providing some amounts of material equipment, depending on what the Indians, have available at that point. So I think they're not really talking of Indian troops in Afghanistan, but rather simply strengthening Afghanistan's capacity to defend itself.
And given that Afghanistan is not a functioning state. It's not a failed state, but it's not a functioning state. And India has pledged, what, $2 billion in assistance. And they've also built a number of roads and some infrastructure already. But compare that to the $8 billion a month that the U.S. is spending. There's obviously a huge difference there.
Absolutely. And I don't think India can ever compensate for a U.S. withdrawal if that withdrawal is either comprehensive or complete. And so I think the Indian calculation going into a partnership with Karzai presumes that the United States will stay engaged at some level or another, and that all that India can do is, in a sense, substitute on the margins. And I think that is Karzai's calculation as well. This agreement that he has reached with India, first, just a couple of facts, let me help put it in context. The agreement was actually ready to be signed when Prime Minister Singh visited Kabul in May earlier this year. But it was deferred being publicly announced, actually at Karzai's own request. And the fact that Karzai has now agreed, in fact pushed, to make the agreement public signals that his calculations are more strategic rather than simply related to, you know, some specific factual things that he may be getting from India.
Well, clearly they're timed in the aftermath of public acrimony expressed by the high United States officials, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen. Prior to that, dissatisfaction with Pakistan was apparently expressed privately by U.S. officials, but this is the first time that it's been publicly pretty much laid on the line by Mullen. The State Department has tried to do some backfilling there, and the president also. I suspect that one of the reasons why Mullen went public in the way that he did, with the intensity and indignation that he expressed, was that he's getting a lot of heat from his own officer corps, the generals and the majors and the captains inside of Afghanistan, who are absolutely furious that they're being essentially shot in the back by the Pakistanis.
And I think that's exactly right. I think Mullen stretched the talking points. He didn't stretch the truth. The fact of the matter is that today, the sanctuary that Pakistan offers a variety of opponents of the alliance is something that is actually undermining what is supposedly a common effort in Afghanistan. And I think Mullen, like many others, had reached the end of his tether and decided to go public, first to signal that the United States is not oblivious to what Pakistan is doing, but second, and I think equally important, trying to force the Obama administration to at least change policy on some key issues pertaining to Pakistan.
But the incident that provoked this, allegedly members of the Haqqani network were able to take over a building under construction and shoot at the U.S. embassy all day. Prior to that, they set off a car bomb that killed, that wounded about 80 NATO soldiers. But apparently, in terms of Afghanistan's ire, it was the assassination of the peace envoy, former President Rabbani, who they've apparently captured a Pakistani who they're holding responsible for that assassination. So it would seem to me that that Karzai is really basically, you know, I don't know whether he's poking the Pakistanis in the eye, but he certainly, I don't think this trip is coincidental.
No, and I agree with that completely. I think although the specific triggers that motivated Mullen to say what he did and the triggers that have moved Karzai to take this very public position of solidarity with India are different, the fact is, from Karzai's perspective, they are really two sides of the same problem. That is, whether it's the Haqqanis or whether it is other individuals, you know, who have been attacking his allies, he sees the problem as essentially a Pakistan which refuses to come to terms with the idea that Afghanistan could be both capable and independent. And so from his vantage point, he sees Pakistan as essentially being the root of all evils that face his country. And at this point, when he is somewhat uncertain about what the security transition means from the point of view of American commitment over the long term, he thinks it is useful to send a signal to Pakistan that he has other arrows in the quiver. And a very important arrow for him is, of course, India, because he is hoping that if nothing else, a public expression of solidarity with India will force Islamabad to, in a sense, rethink its current strategy towards Kabul. Now, whether that pays off remains to be seen, but he is at least, you know, attempting to exercise these other gambits, because I think he finds himself running out of options.
But Ashley Tellis, again, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, there isn't one Pakistan. It's often said that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And what upset Mullen was directed at ISI and the military. But the government, of course, the civilian government, weak as it is, you know, had to defend the nation's honor, as it were. So there seems to be two governments here. The permanent one, the military one.
There always have been.
Yeah. But I understand that the civilian government, weak as it is actually trying to mend fences with India.
And that has been true for a while. In fact, when President Zardari, you know, ascended to office, he did launch peace overtures and has been trying to kind of put the building blocks, you know, for a peace process in place. The difficulty is that on the key issues that matter in the India-Pakistan relationship, those key issues which have to do with national security, that have to do with the use of jihadist proxies, which have to do with the nuclear weapons programs, and the way Pakistan reacts to India's presence in Afghanistan. On all these issues, it's the Pakistan army that calls the shots. And so, yes, President Zardari does find himself in a somewhat awkward situation that he has to, in a sense, run interference and protect Pakistan's honor, as you pointed out, because the Pakistan army has been, you know, taking it in the neck, you know, as a result of both American and Afghan complaints. But that's unfortunately the history of Pakistan, and, you know, I think Zardari is just doing the best he can to cope with what are very difficult political circumstances at home.
But what's the U.S. doing here apart from getting out? I understand that when Holbrooke came in and was given that job as being the special envoy between for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he wanted to have a global authority also over the Indian portfolio and try to settle the Kashmir issue, figuring that if you settle the animosity between Pakistan and India, then Afghanistan becomes less of a problem. That seems pretty logical to me. He got nowhere with that.
I think the theory is absolutely right. I think the practice is going to be harder to implement, because if you think of fixing Afghanistan and Afghan-Pakistan and India-Pakistan relations is hard enough, fixing Kashmir first as the prerequisite to doing everything else right, I think, is an even harder task. I mean, a solution to Kashmir has eluded us for 60 years. And as long as the Pakistan army has the attitude that it does to Kashmir, I don't think you're going to find a solution anytime soon. So my problem with Holbrooke was not the theory, but in a sense, he ended up putting, you know, the cart before the horse. I think you will get a solution to Kashmir as a result of India-Pakistan reconciliation and not the other way around.
What thwarted Holbrooke was pressure from India, not from Pakistan.
Well, yes, of course. But the problem still remains the same, that there was simply no way in which Holbrooke could have engineered a solution to Kashmir. The Indians and the Pakistanis, since from 2003 to 2007, actually had a very productive set of conversations about the future of Kashmir and what the solution might be. And President Musharraf had actually signed on to an agreement in principle, which General Kiani walked away from. And so I think from an Indian perspective, until they got very clear signals that General Kiani was willing to, in a sense, go back to the negotiating table and carry that framework agreement that the Indians and Pakistanis had in principle, they had absolutely no interest in seeing Holbrooke interject himself into something that, you know, most people who look at this closely agree is better solved by Indians and Pakistanis alone.
Not that it has. You just said they've got nowhere in 60 years.
Well, they did make progress in the last decade.
Sure.
And the interesting thing is that progress has been most conspicuous when the United States has stood out.
Well, but we also know that when Indian and Pakistan start to get together, when their foreign ministers meet, for example, recently they met, and on the very moment that they met, the Mumbai attack happened. It's not hard to figure out what that's all about.
That's exactly right.
So what's happening now with Zardari and Manmohan Singh? Because Zardari seems to be quite genuine in trying to work something out here.
Well, the difficulty that we have in India-Pakistan relations is that the part of the Pakistan government that deeply cherishes a peace with India, which is the civilians, that part of the government is essentially powerless to make that peace.
I see.
And the part of the government that is capable of making the peace, which is the army, has its own interests in a continued standoff with India. And until this circle can be squared on the Pakistani end, I don't think you're going to get a very successful peace process. Now, what happened between 2003 and 2007 is that for the first time, the Pakistan army in the person of General Musharraf was actually eager to consummate this peace. And it's really unfortunate that General Musharraf ended up exiting office in the circumstances that he did before he was able to, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's on the agreement.
Sure, it's just one of those things like it takes a Nixon to make a deal with communist China.
That's exactly it.
So just in closing then, Ashley, tell us, there is in this agreement about which we know little, but there have been some details announced that between Afghanistan and India that's been announced today in the state visit of President Karzai. Apparently it involves some energy issues involving pipelines, and we know that there's been a lot of talk about that forever. Afghanistan has signed a transit trade agreement with Pakistan that allowed agricultural products from Afghanistan to cross Pakistan into India. That's a good sign. Would they be able to allow a pipeline from which they could both benefit?
There is no reason why that, you know, can't and shouldn't happen. There has been a negotiation now for what is called a TAPI pipeline, which is a Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, which the U.S. is very strongly backing. And if the Afghan-Pakistan transit trade agreement can actually be expanded to go beyond agricultural products to small manufacturers and energy, I think that would be a win-win for all the three countries involved.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Ashley Tallis.
A pleasure to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Ashley Tallis, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He previously was commissioned into the Foreign Service and served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi. He was also senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and served on the National Security Council staff as a special assistant to the President and Senior Director for Strategic Planning in Southwest Asia. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the health of President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Javier Carreras, who is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. Previously, he was a visiting scholar at the Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard and a visiting fellow at the Center for Latin American Research at the University of Amsterdam. He is the co-author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, and author of Presidents Without Parties, The Politics of Economic Reform in Argentina and Venezuela in the 1990s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Corrales.
Thank you very much.
And the President Hugo Chavez, just the other night, after a Miami newspaper had suggested that he had had kidney failure and had to go into an emergency military hospital, 48 hours later, wearing a bright red tracksuit and clutching a baseball, he invited a local journalist to visit him at 11 a.m. in the morning at the Miraflores Presidential Palace in Caracas, where he said, I'm fine, those who don't love me and wish me ill, well, bad luck. So here we have a 57-year-old Chavez having been treated for cancer, saying that all is well. Do you think that will dampen the rumor mill?
Well, it did serve to stop that particular rumor, but it will not do away with all the speculation that continues to exist surrounding the situation, his health condition. And the reason is that the government in general offers so little information about the status of President Cancer's health condition that in many ways the government is inviting all this speculation. What Chavez is going to want to do is to put an end to any discussion that he's not getting well. The talk has been, I have cancer, yes, this is in many ways all that Chavez likes to talk or tweet about, but that in general, things are looking great. A message of optimism and of, in some ways, rebirth. And that is what he wants to convey to Venezuelans and the world.
But this has been going on since early July when Chavez admitted that he had cancer and that the doctors had found what he described as a strange formation in the pelvic region. And he went on to say, I have neglected my health and I was reluctant to have medical checkups. It was a fundamental mistake for a revolutionary.
That's correct. After trying to hide the situation, he had a prolonged stay in Cuba and there was no explanation given. He finally came out and revealed that much. Essentially, a baseball-size tumor, malignant tumor, was removed from his pelvic area. But nothing more has been revealed since then about what kind of cancer it was and what else is going on. We do know that, or he says that he has received 4 treatments, chemotherapy treatments since then, and that's pretty much it. That's all we know.
Again, I'm speaking with Javier Corrales, the professor of political science at Amherst College and co-author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. Now, it was just announced that the presidential elections would be held on October the 7th next year. That's just about a month before U.S. Presidential elections. And President Hugo Chavez said he expected to govern for at least 2 more 6-year terms until 2025. For any politician, that's fairly optimistic scenario. If he didn't have this health problem, what would his prognosis be?
If he didn't have his health problem, I think the prognosis would be that he would stand a good chance of winning, but not a guaranteed chance. There's currently a tie in Venezuela. All polls suggest that President Chavez, for quite a while now, has a 50% approval rating. It goes up and down a little bit. That's a different question from whom do you intend to vote? If the question is whom do you intend to vote, he probably might have 30% But that's pretty good because there is the one group of voters who's undecided. So he continues to be competitive, certainly not as competitive as he once was, certainly in 2006, which was the peak of his popularity. It all, of course, hinges on his health and if the opposition manages to stay united. If the opposition fragments into two candidates, that's it. But if the opposition produces a single candidate and all other candidates rally behind that particular candidate, then this is going to be a an election in which Hugo Chavez could easily get nervous about.
And Venezuela is a really polarized country politically.
Yes.
I mean, it's poisonously polarized. It also has a high and growing crime rate. So there's a lot of insecurity. What is the possibility here of this problem? And apparently, my understanding is it's prostate cancer that spread into the pelvis. That he has this macho image, and he doesn't hold back in some of his television and his 6-7 hour long appearances on television and radio in Venezuela, about his manhood, etc.
Right.
How's that going to play now that he's had chemotherapy and shaved head, and that there's that questions about his health. It's not going to obviously not helping.
Well, him being ill affects him in two ways. First, I think there will be many folks in the electorate who might not be inclined to vote for a president who appears frail. Just in general, it doesn't seem that the sympathy vote is going to be large enough to compensate for those who feel that this is not a worthwhile gamble. The other way in which his illness might affect him is that you're absolutely right. He has always presented the image of an incredibly vigorous, highly energetic, on 24 hours a day, running a campaign all the time. And for just pure health reasons, he cannot sustain that rhythm, that pace. And consequently, you're going to see a lot less of Chavez during the campaign. And this is going to cost him. His voters are used to the cheerleading effect of Chavez, and that is just not going to happen, at least for a while. And this is going to affect his electoral prospects. But then again, I don't want to create the image that he faces the possibility of an easy defeat. Even if ill, he can still manage an electoral victory.
Well, during the Clinton era, Jim Carville coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid," and most analysts think that President Obama, whose election will be about a month later than the one that Chavez will be facing in Venezuela.
Yes.
The prognosis for him is pretty grim. Nobody's been reelected since Roosevelt with over 9% unemployment, and it's likely to get worse. Venezuela's economy's even worse. Inflation's is outrageous. And but for a line of credit from the Chinese, Chavez would be in terrible trouble.
Correct. There's no question that bad economic conditions are terrible for any incumbent, and Venezuela is no exception there. However, what does happen is that in incredibly polarized environments, the voters for the ruling party can become very forgiving, simply because they hate the other side so much. This is in some ways the definition of a polarized environment, that you will just stick to your group because you detest the other camp viscerally.
Now is the likely candidate of the other camp, meaning the Bolivarian circles hate the oligarchs or the remnants of the oligarchs, and they continually refer to Miami as being where the strings are pulled. What kind of a candidate do they have? Do they have somebody that represents the old discredited ruling elite, or do they have somebody that's more presentable?
Not at all. I don't think that any of the candidates at the moment fit the image that any reasonable person would have of a Latin American oligarch. There are about five or six viable candidates at the moment. Most of them are very young. Most of them have formed their political careers under the Chavez period. They come from completely new parties. They have experience in office. And they are not connected to the previous era whatsoever. And so they are new faces for the most part. There is one who has a bit of a connection to the previous era, not necessarily to the economic oligarchy, but he's not doing that well. The two leading contenders at the moment at the opposition, in my opinion, don't fit the bill of an oligarch. The opposition as a whole has been able to, in the most recent election, the 2010 election for midterm elections for parliament, the opposition obtained more votes than the ruling party. And so to label the majority of the country as oligarchic seems to be a strange designation, because almost by definition you cannot have more than majority of a country be oligarchic. But that is the tactic that they use. And the point is that they do see the opposition as completely unacceptable, that an alternation of power to the opposition, they see it as a return to a world that they never want to see again. And this is not exactly the fabric for a democratic system, when you see the opposition as completely unacceptable. So we'll see what happens. There is the question of will Chavez win or lose, and if he wins, what will his next government be? But then there is the more important question of, in the event that he loses, will they step down? Will the government step down? And that is it's going to be a critical question for those of us who study Venezuelan politics.
Well, just in closing then, Javier Corrales, the Chinese, when they gave Hugo Chavez this line of credit that's largely keeping the country solvent, they made sure that the Congress signed off on it so that that they're going to get their money paid back. So it would seem that the Chinese are sort of looking to the future and not entirely convinced that he's going to last.
The Chinese have become the most important financiers of Venezuela. They have provided $8 billion in investments plus a $20 billion line of credit, and the Chinese have become kind of nervous. They have become kind of nervous that that Venezuela is not going to be able to pay back, that these investments are not going to produce any significant returns. And this is one of the reasons that people are saying Venezuela recently made the decision to transfer almost $11 billion worth of gold in reserves that Venezuela held abroad, transfer them to Venezuela, as well as liquid reserves, which were transferred from the United States and Europe and were deposited in the hands of the Chinese and Russia and Brazil. In other words, it seems that the Chinese are now exerting quite a bit of pressure on the Venezuelan regime to deliver on some of its economic and financial commitments to the Chinese.
Well, I thank you. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'm sorry to say, okay. Javier. But thank you so much for joining us, Javier Corrales.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, Javier Corrales is a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the – so that was a bit too hot. Let's start again. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? We began talking with one of the people from Friends of the Earth who got the Freedom of Information information request from the State Department that delivered emails from the former deputy campaign manager of Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign, now working for the Canadian company that wants to build a pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta across the United States to refineries in Texas. He was been in correspondence with the State Department in an apparently very cozy relationship where instead of the State Department exercising oversight, they appear to be facilitating this oil pipeline. Kim Nguyen, I should say, the director of the Dirty Fuels Program at the Friends of the Earth, was pretty insistent that the State Department should get the hell out of this position. They've discredited themselves. It's in the hands of the president to approve this pipeline, and he should not approve this pipeline, not to mention various environmental reasons, but the fact that already this process has been flawed because the company, the State Department, basically chose a company that's closely associated with the Canadian company that Hillary's deputy campaign manager is lobbying for. They chose this company to do the environmental impact study. And needless to say, surprise, surprise, they all said, oh, it's going to be fine, even though the State Department coached them in saying, lowball the amount of pressure in the pipes because they're not compliant with American laws, and then later you can up the pressure once you get the approval. So that's our government at work. Ashley Tellis joined us. He was on the National Security Council specialist on India. We're talking about the strategic agreement between President Karzai of Afghanistan and Prime Minister of Singh of India. This is the first agreement that Afghanistan has made with any other country, clearly designed to fill the strategic vacuum as NATO and the U.S. withdraw from Afghanistan in 2014. And clearly it's going to antagonize Pakistan. But there's no way that India intends to replace the United States as a military presence, but they would like obviously to have a viable state. But India's dealings with Pakistan, of course, are prickly. And when you're dealing with Pakistan, there are two governments. There's the military and the civilian government. The civilian government wants peace with India. The military government wants a continued confrontation in order to justify their existence. Finally, I spoke with Javier Corrales, a specialist on Venezuela, about Hugo Chavez and the elections that are coming up a month before our elections in 2012. Who are the likely players, and how much is Hugo Chavez's health problems likely to be a factor in the elections? He said that his supporters hate the opposition so much that it won't matter. But the opposition are, in fact, recruiting candidates that have nothing to do with the old oligarchy, but are actually fairly viable candidates. So we'll see what happens. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.